morning. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We have Larry on the line. Larry, I'd like to ask if you were able to tune in and hear the end of my discussion with Glenn at the end of the last hour.
Well, I was just then too.
All right. Let me kind of explain what he said, and I'd like to, rather than immediately go to the next of the 10 statements that Yah etched in stone, to speak about this, because should he have raised a question that others might have in their mind, I think it behooves us to discuss it. But his thought was that I'm conveying my teaching and my doctrine. And I'm not here to be the least bit defensive. That wouldn't be productive. But I do want to make certain that the folks who are listening to this know that I'm not conveying my teaching or my doctrine.
I'd like to add something here. Okay, first of all, I happen to know Yada had to completely rewrite an entire 2,500 pages, roughly, because he came to understand that Paul was a fraud.
Right.
You know, people who have time invested in books generally don't like to do that. Secondly, no. what I...
As a matter of fact, I've devoted the last 9 months of my life to actually rewriting Questioning Paul, because... Not because I have discovered that what I originally wrote was untrue. It's that I've discovered that what I wrote was incomplete, that the evidence against him is so much worse than what I originally saw, that now, based upon knowing more and understanding better, I'm devoting what will end up being over a year of my life to the text that I least enjoy, which is the exposure of Pauline doctrine. I think that the point there, Larry, is that those who go out on a limb and say that they have their own unique inside doctrine or teaching are almost always unwilling to admit that they're wrong. And they're almost never willing to go back and say, you know, that wasn't as accurate as it could be. And so what that does shares two things: that learning is a process. And if you're engaged in the process of learning, then you will constantly be refining what you know. And you will find that there's things along the way that you had previously thought to be true that really aren't true. A great example would be that having been a Christian in my youth, that I thought that the covenant had been renewed. And so I spoke of the so-called Christian New Testament as the renewed covenant. But when I was writing Questioning Paul, after I'd written and published it, I received letters from Christians criticizing it based upon the fact that Paul was announcing the new covenant, which is different than the old one. Therefore, Paul could contradict the old covenant and still be right because he was announcing the new covenant. And so I turned to the Yirmiyahu 31 passage where God actually speaks of renewing his covenant
and repairing and restoring.
Right,
and so
and
I was going to say new, where it really says renewing, repairing,
right,
and restoring.
Yeah, but what I found there is that my previous understanding of the covenant was wrong, because what it says is first that the renewal and the restoration of the covenant isn't with the Gentiles, and therefore it can't be with the Christian church. It's with
right.
It's with Yehuda and Yisrael.
And just down from there, the way he tells us that it'll be renewed is he will write the Torah in our hearts.
He says the only difference between the covenant as it currently exists and my reaffirmation of the covenant is that I'm going to place a copy of my Torah right inside of you. And so you say, wait a minute.
Or anybody trashing the Torah has to be a liar. And by the way,
that's correct. And it also means that since that hasn't happened yet, that the covenant has not yet been renewed. And so when you're faced with God's testimony, and if God's testimony is in conflict with a conclusion that you have formed or an opinion that you have formed, you have a choice.
You can rethink your opinion, or you can stay on the wrong side of the issue. That is
the choice. And so at that moment you say, oh my goodness, all of the times that I referred to the Christian New Testament as the renewed covenant writings, I need to go back and change all of that because that's not true.
Look, you also made a statement earlier that, all this material's out there. Sure, all this material's out there because of people like you, Yada, where you've taken extant material and thrown it down and shown the words and shown the options. And it's up to people to go to those options. It was Marcion that decided to publish a book, calling it a New Testament, and throwing Yahweh's words aside, calling them Old Testament or out of vogue.
Right.
And it's up to people to decide, can a man really do that with the words of the very creator of the universe? Can he usurp them? Can he say they're trash, Old Testament, out of vogue, out of date, throw them aside and take the letters from a man, put them in a book and say, now we have a new God. And essentially that's what happened here.
Yeah. Now, can Paul be telling the truth to say that he was authorized by God to negate everything that God said and to replace it with an entirely different approach? Is it possible, A, that God could have inspired someone to negate and to demean everything that he said, which is what Paul's letters do, and then if your answer to that is yes, that God inspired someone to denounce and demean everything he said and authorize this new person to create an entirely different approach that God himself was obviously incapable of conceiving, then you'd have to say, all right, if God is thereby admitting that he was incapable of coming up with a way to save someone, that if his way failed, then what is the possibility that the new way that he is allegedly authorizing will succeed?
Well, it's impossible. And by the way, Yahweh tells us exactly how he repairs, redeems, and restores the covenant. And he says he does it through the called out assemblies. And who fulfills those called out assemblies? Well, Yahweh does.
Yeah, and actually the called out assemblies and the... in the Greek, are really nothing more than a translation of the Hebrew Mikra. And the Mikra are the seven steps that we walk to Yahweh. For example, when Shimon Kefesh recognizes at the time he was simply Shimon, he listens, he became Kefesh, the rock, after making the statement. When he referred to Yahusha as the one who had been prepared and set apart to serve, Yahusha responded by saying that upon this rock, upon this foundation, I'm going to build my, and then he said, Mikra. My called out invitations to meet with me.
He didn't say church.
No, it was the closest Greek word to Mikra happens to be ecclesia, and so he was translated as saying ecclesia, and the Christian church changed ecclesia to church after the name of a pagan sun goddess.
They copy-edited that out.
Right. So, if you really dig into what Yahweh said, you can learn a great deal, and that's really the entire purpose of Yadaya, of the introduction to God, of questioning Paul, of this program, is to prioritize what Yahweh said, to closely examine and carefully consider his testimony, so that you come to A, know what he said, B, understand what he said, and C, are now positioned, if you're open to his guidance, to respond to what he said. So let's just take a moment and say, what did God tell us? He introduces himself by saying that he's the creator of the universe, the author of life. Do you think his presentation of the universal creation and of authoring life is credible.
If you're asking me, I mean, that's what made me come to realize this is all real. I came to question that, you know, the doctrines, something you and I don't have. We don't have doctrines, by the way.
No.
I came to question all these man-made doctrines that are obviously errant. But what made me come to realize it's all true were things like relativity, things like the dimensions of the ark. I always wondered, why did he write these dimensions of the ark down? And what I know now is he was describing a ship so perfectly advanced that we can barely do that today. That's only, I mean, its equivalents are only in our most advanced warships, as an example.
So when Yahweh used terms like Big Bang in his creation account, when Yahweh spoke of mighty reptiles, which are the dinosaurs, in his creation account, when he used the Hebrew term for relativity throughout his creation account, when he begins creation explaining the nature of energy, which is light, when he describes the order that life was conceived, from whence life was conceived, and the entire evolution of life in his creation account,
and
you find that his testimony is 100% right. Is 100% consistent.
Time rolls out. That's what we find in the fossil record of each epoch of time or given day where he says he made something. Of course, it's credible. In fact, in the only credible writings in the world, in the world anywhere. Stem from the Torah.
Yeah, in fact, Larry, let me just throw something out at you. The question of credibility is important, because if the creation account in the Torah is credible, then Yahweh, who is the author of that creation account, is indeed
Must
God.
Must be credible.
Right,
yeah.
And therefore his testimony is credible. One of the things that was profound for me, and I know has been profound for many people, is that the first seven or eight chapters of Yada Yah are devoted to the creation account. And one of the things that we found is that if you look at the microwave background radiation that's screaming out from the Big Bang, and you look at the length that wavelength has been stretched, that you can determine an answer that is so profound, it answers that question, and we'll answer it when Shattering Myths returns after the break. Back to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. We're having a conversation with Larry. We're talking about Yah's testimony and what we can deduce from it. And at the end of the last segment, we were talking about timing. Yahweh tells us that he's the creator, that he was a witness to and the catalyst for creation. He literally said that he spoke words spoke the universe into existence using words. When we take the realization that we have learned that time is relative, it moves more slowly in the presence of either great velocity or great mass, to the point of almost stalling, and that time moves vastly more quickly in the presence of a lot less mass. Now, if we take the cosmic microwave radiation that is eminently measurable from the Big Bang, and we look at the wavelength, that the stretching of the wavelength, it's stretched to 10 to the 12th power, isn't it, Larry?
That's correct. And there's four ways to deduce that. They all come out to 10 to the 12th power.
Right. And we know that from the commencement of the Big Bang, not from the commencements of creation, but the time that energy was capable of forming matter, because prior to the formation of matter, time, as we know it in terms of the flow of time, does not exist. So all that scientists can do is look back from a timing point of view, is look at when Yahweh conceived light, time did not commence. Time commenced once light was able to coalesce into matter. We know that occurred approximately 14 billion years ago. And there would have to be some time prior to that where light existed as energy and time did not flow. Now, if you take that 14 billion years And you divide that time by first take it into days. So you take 14 billion years divided by 365 to get to the number of, or multiply that by the number of days. So the 14 billion years times 365 days in a year, and you divide that by 10 to the 12th power. God said that He created the universe.
Yeah, He said 24-hour periods of time.
Yeah, so God said that from my perspective at creation, it took six 24-hour days. And you do the math, and from a witness at creation, it took exactly six 24-hour days.
Yeah, that's based on all known science.
Right.
You know,
so
not Christian science.
No, not just plain old, that's just the evidence. And so when you're confronted with that realization, and you say, just a coincidence that it would come to the same number that he testified to 3,500 years ago, you have a choice. You can say, you know, that rascally Moshe, he just got lucky. He guessed correctly, son of a gun.
Yeah.
Or do you think maybe he was actually taking dictation from the fellow who was actually there and made it happen? When scientists realized about 60 years ago that the universe had a beginning, that it was created as opposed to had always existed, and it just so happens
it's expanding, and it's expanding, which
right.
they thought it was a constant.
And you look at Yah's testimony that's 3,500 years old that says that it was created and it's expanding, and by the way, it was created in what's called what he uses as a Big Bang. That's the term that he uses in Hebrew. You can just say, you know, that rascally Moshe, he must have been one really smart dude. He just got lucky. Or when God says, you know, I'm going to conceive life, and I'm going to start with plant life, and I'm going to begin with plant life in the oceans, and that's what we find. That rascally Moshe, boy, I tell you what, he must have been a really smart dude. Or maybe he was listening to the Creator God of the universe. And then when God speaks of animal life, and he speaks of it as a giant explosion of life, and we find the Cambrian explosion when every type of life that we know today came to exist in an instant. What do you think? The Moshe just got lucky on everything that he said? Or somewhere along
he
the lines...
He would have been brilliant beyond anything known to man, or somebody was telling him what happened. That's it.
Right. He was educated in the Egyptian education system. Was anybody else in Egypt so brilliantly inclined? Do we have, or were the Egyptians muttering about all sorts of pagan gods and the muttering about the sun actually being a god?
Yeah, obviously that's a rhetorical question,
yeah,
because that's exactly what they were
so
doing.
So how could this guy that was educated there be so much brighter than all of those scholars that educated him?
Yeah, right. I mean,
okay. When Yahweh uses the term, and he says that the flood that is associated with Noah was the result of an upwelling of seawater, of ocean water, of salt water, and we find that the Burkle crater impact was exactly at the time that Yahweh said that the flood occurred, and it flooded that region that he said the flood occurred up through Mesopotamia through an upwelling of seawater. Ought we be impressed? Or just discount that? We're having a very interesting discussion prompted by something that was spoken during the first hour. I've got both Scott and Larry here, and as we move through this segment, I'm going to turn the program over to the two of them as I do something on behalf of my wife. The reason that we have gone through this, Larry and Scott, is that Yahweh provided testimony to us whereby anyone who is open to what he had to say, who thinks about what he has to say, who compares what he had to say with our known reality, will come to the conclusion that he, in fact, is God, that he, in fact, created the universe, that he authored life, that he is the author of the very book that he presents this information in, which is called the Torah. Just a little last thought on the Noah experience with the Burkle crater and the upwelling of seawater. One of the interesting things is that we have determined over the last 10 years that the Black Sea not only had the world's most advanced civilizations around it 5,000 years ago, but that the Black Sea went instantly, one moment to the next, from freshwater to saltwater, with the welling up of the tidal, the tsunami that occurred after the impact of the Burkle Crater, right at 5,000 years ago, just as God said was going to happen. And so he provides all of this information that is designed for a singular purpose, introduce himself to us so as to know who he is and so that we can trust the document that he is authoring. And what does he transition to next, Larry?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure where we're at here.
All right. Well, what he transitions to next.
After,
all right. No, after he tells you the story of Noah and what he did 5,000 years ago, after that story, what is the next thing that he wants to talk about? He goes to Babylon, doesn't he? And he introduces himself to a fella named Abram.
Oh, Abram, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he walks him out of Babylon, and then we get into the covenant.
Right. In fact, he spends the rest of the Torah talking about that covenant relationship. And so he goes from, I want to introduce myself, I want you to know exactly who I am. I'm going to prove that I exist, God proving that he exists, and that proving that he authored his testimony, and he transitions immediately to his discussions with Abraham and the formation of the covenant. Do you
Which tells us he's breaking down, look, I'm real, if you care to investigate this on any level you want to, I'm real. And what I'm interested in is a family relationship. And he does say family relationship.
Right. So at that point, would it be astute to pay attention to what he has to say about this family relationship and how Abram became Abraham and became the first, along with his wife Sarah, and then their child Yishak, to participate in this family? Would you not, if you were interested in getting to know God, developing a relationship with him, and being able to be saved by him, would you not, therefore, devote all of your free time and energies to prioritizing understanding what he said about this relationship? Were there terms and conditions of the relationship? Were there benefits of the relationship? What did God have to say about that relationship? Would not that be your priority in life?
Absolutely. Sure. Because what he's offering, by the way, what he's offering to people, and he doesn't mince words, is empowering you as a family member to tenfold, to the tenth power.
Yeah, that's the fifth of the five benefits of the covenant.
Yeah, and it's incredible. You know, one of the things I wanted to, I just like to throw out here, you know, Yada, if you invited me and over for a steak dinner or something at your place, and you said we're going to discuss Yahweh's words, and I walked in with a Textus Receptus and started mouthing them to you as though they were even accurate or even the word of the Creator himself, and I sat down and I said to you that you know, grace be with you in this we should strive to be holy, and I sat down and started parroting to you that the beginning of all knowledge comes from fear of the Lord. You'd say, you know, Larry, I thought you had actually studied, you know, Yahweh's words, wouldn't you? I mean, wouldn't you want to throw me out at that point? I mean, if I could actually do that.
My response would be the same response that I had on a radio show, interview that I did yesterday, where a caller came in and said that I was saved by, he claimed that he was saved by the name of Jesus, and that God created all languages, and that therefore Jesus was a perfectly good name because God created that name. And my response would be the same as it always is in those circumstances. If someone approaches me conveying a religious lie, a statement that is both irrational and ignorant, I will immediately confront the statement and try to share with them what it is that they have said that is erroneous.
He didn't create all languages, though.
No, he only created one language. And while he doesn't say, I created Hebrew, when you make a right. He said he created the universe by speaking it into existence, and the language that he reveals that he spoke the universe into existence with, Haya Or, for example, let light exist, was Hebrew. He then says once he created man, he began to have a conversation with him. That means that man didn't create the language that he had a conversation with Adam with. God did. And there's only one language on earth that the verb tenses exist throughout time, that they're not stuck in time, and therefore they mirror Yahweh's eternal nature, and that happens to be Hebrew. There's only one language that every verb is affixed with a stem that shows relationships between the subject and the object.
And it's Hebrew. Not affected by time.
Right. And there's only one language where virtually every mood is conveyed in a volitional tense, talking about free will.
I want to take this just a little further, though. Let's look at this. And Scott, you chime in any time here. I'm going to read Yahshayahu, but I want to preface it with this. Didn't the Savior, Yahusha, Yahweh saves, didn't he say, how can you say you believe in me and you rely on me, and yet you do not do the things that I do? Scott, do you suppose that he expected you to make the dead walk, or me to make the dead walk?
No, I don't think he expects that. He did it himself.
No, I don't either. And what he says here, and this is right in line with how Yahweh says he redeems and restores the covenant, the Son of Man strengthens, establishes, restores, and renews. He carefully observes and keeps the Sabbath from being profaned, defiled, dishonored, and carefully keeping him from doing anything harmful or evil. That's Yahshayahu, or Yasha being but salvation, and Yahu being Yahweh, so salvation is from Yahweh, 56:2. We call that Isaiah, which is meaningless today. Okay? But the Son of Man says he what? He keeps the seventh day. He keeps the Shabbat. He keeps the Sabbath. Now, how could anyone in their right mind follow some writing that says, I keep one day set apart versus another, what does it matter? Isn't that what Paul said? Isn't that what he said?
Yeah, and it's also what Muhammad said. He kept a different day.
So when the Savior asks somebody, how can you say you are reliant on me and you follow my path, but yet you don't do what I do, what do they suppose he's talking about? Raising the dead? Feeding the poor? Is that what they think?
I have no idea what they think. I mean, yeah, it's foolish to change the day, because that's the day that he says that he wants to spend with us.
That's right, and it's to observe, to understand. And what are we to understand? Well, the seventh day equals the 7,000 years that since the fall of Adam. And what will we be doing? We'll sukkah. We will tabernacle. We will camp out with Yahweh for that 1,000 years. Isn't that what it's really about? We're trying to get to that seventh day, because we were just talking about time. And from Yahweh's perspective, he's still on day six. Now, he's seconds away from, you know, day seven and about to walk in, and that's 20 years now in our future. Yep. But at the same time, that's what he's discussing all through his Torah. That's what Yahusha was affirming and reaffirming. So I don't get the Christian mindset. We'll just make up a religion based on the life and times of Yahusha, and then on top of it, we'll change everything he said and did, because that's what it looks like to me.
And tarnish it, and make it something that it's not supposed to be. He has a name, and they don't want to use it.
Yeah, well, he makes that very clear. Now, if at the same time, in these seven instructions that Yahweh wrote down, he says, remember that the Sabbath day is set apart, 6 days. You can actually and continuously work. You can genuinely engage in the totality of all your service of representing the messenger and proclaiming the message. But the seventh day, the HaShabbat, the Sabbath of Yahweh, your God, Mighty One, you shall never actually engage in any part of the work of God's representatives and messenger yourself, your son, your daughter, your male and female servants and staff, your means of production, as well as those who relationally are in your home, property, or community. For indeed, in 6 days, Yahweh acted and engaged, preparing, producing, everything associated with completing and accordingly the heavens and the earth and the seas and all which relationally is in them, and he became completely settled during the Almighty's HaShavi, the seventh day. Therefore, this day, the Sabbath, is to be set apart. Now, how could any man change that?
Well, by
Realistically, through lies.
He had alternative means. He wasn't trying to get something else. That sounds like, what you just read sounds like a great thing for me. And, you know, easy to understand. The Father wants to spend time with me on that day. You know, he's asking me that don't do anything else. Come pay attention to me on this day.
And the seventh day, it falls perfectly within the perfect plan that Yahweh lays out to begin. Thank you. The Shattering Myths. We'll be back right after the break. Back to Shattering Myths. I'm Larry, and I'm talking with Scott right now. We were just going over Shemoth 2010. And I just want to reemphasize here, it says, but the seventh day, the Sabbath, Shabbat, of Yahweh, your Elohim, you shall not do any part of the work of God's representative messenger yourself, nor your son, your daughter, your servants and employees, your means of production, and those visitors who relationally are in your home, property, or community. And that's Shemoth, or what we call today Exodus. Shemoth means names. And that's 2010. Now, that was unambiguous and authoritative, Scott. So what do you suppose was the motivation for the imperial edict Constantine's historian Eusebius recorded in 321 CE when it said this, all things whatsoever that is the duty to do on the Sabbath, these shall be transferred to the Lord's Day. And then the founder of Roman Catholicism called it Sol Invictus Mithras, the day of the unconquerable sun Mithras. Under penalty of death, he decreed all within the empire must cease work on Sunday to honor the sun god. What do you suppose was the motivation behind that, Scott?
I think it's the same thing that all religions have sprung from. They've taken a bit of truth and then they pervert it into something else to give them to make people believe that they are the ones that can talk to God.
They're the intermediaries.
They're the intermediators. They're the authorities. Yeah.
Yeah, and then Yahweh has to become a lord, by the way, because you have to bow before lords.
Which is something that he said that he is absolutely against.
Now, we're used to political actors and people in power today being total hypocrites, aren't we? I mean, they take lying to a whole nother art form. I mean, really, they do. Dancing on the head of a pin.
Same thing as depends
on what sex is. You know, things like this.
There's really no difference in political actors and religious people. No, they both do their own thing.
Right, and the people in power were primarily, what they did was melded, religion and government
politics,
authority
yep.
together.
Yep.
Yeah, and now just so we know, I'm going to go back to the statement that was made in Yashayahu, Isaiah 56:2. The Son of Man strengthens, establishes, restores, and renews. He carefully observes and keeps the Sabbath from being profaned, defiled, or dishonored, carefully keeping him from doing anything harmful or evil. Now, it sounds like he walks it like he talks it, which is something we're just not used to. I think the reason that they can get away with this kind of thing is we're so used to people representing power and authority, changing things, you know, moving like slippery lizards and snakes through our hands and through our grasp, performing magic acts, if you will. We're turning white, black, and black, white, and
it's the same.
Everything gets turned on its head, turned inside out, but yet Yahweh walks it like he talks it. Now, I want to go back to the original thing I asked. If somebody says they're following the Savior, number one, they've changed his name and therefore disassociated him from Yahweh, since Yahusha is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh that's set apart from him. And then they turn around, change the name, then they change the Sabbath, and then they change everything that it represents, and they change the Moed. You know, as Yada just pointed out, they change, you know, Mikre to to church.
Yep.
You know, which is a religious institution full of religious books, religious paraphernalia, paid actors on stages. Even if they're sincere, they're sincerely wrong.
Yeah. It's because they don't question things. It's the same reason why political actors do have what they have. People don't question things. They just this is what it's supposed to be, and then they go about their lives.
Well, you know, I say if the Son of Man did it, I probably want to do it too.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I really can't say I follow his path. Thank you. This has been Larry Scott, setting in for Yada. We'll see you tomorrow on another edition of Shattering Myths.